What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Well, welcome to EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We're asking the question, as we do every day, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? If you'd like to try to answer that question, give us a call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, that number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address is ctc@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, sitting in today for Tom Price. Charles Beery's producing the program. And your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Jeff Burson, handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host is here every day, Dr. David Anders. How are you?
Jack, I'm doing fine, thanks. How about you?
It's great. I hear there's a rumor going around.
Which is?
There's going to be sunshine in Birmingham tomorrow.
Oh, that'll be fantastic.
I thought we had relocated to Seattle. We haven't seen the sun in quite a little while now, and
it's been kind of miserable,
but it's just winter. We forget it by the time it comes around every year, but it's just winter, right?
Yeah.
Got an email here from Steve. He said, years ago I left the church after my confirmation because I found the vernacular mass to be spiritually unfulfilling as compared to the Latin mass. Recently I've begun attending a Latin mass. Now I find out that Latin masses aren't going to be allowed, even though an earlier pope had made the agreement to allow them. Can you discuss why this change happened again?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you the reasons that Pope Francis gave for this decision. And I understand that the pope's explanations may not apply to your specific community. I've heard that from a number of people, but this is was what the pope said. He felt that the Latin Mass or traditionalist movement in general across the Universal Church has oftentimes become an occasion for kind of sectarian spirit in the church that would set itself in particular against the Holy Father and sometimes against the Second Vatican Council, and was an occasion even for specific acts of disobedience against bishops and so forth. Now, I know a lot of people who are big fans of the Latin Mass, and they say that does not describe me and it does not describe my community. And if that's the case, then those people are collateral damage, if you will. And that's a terrible tragedy that they would not be able to celebrate the Mass in a way that they find edifying. However, I will say that I have visited traditionalist communities and I know people involved in the movement about whom the Pope's reservations are absolutely accurate, because I have encountered people from this community, from this movement, who would represent themselves as being in opposition to the Pope, to the Second Vatican Council, and to the Universal Church, and absolutely understand themselves to be a party or a sect apart, and the pure and the elect and the only people who have it right, and that kind of disposition, which, of course, is flat contrary to the demands of Christian charity, which at the end of the day are the only criterion ultimately valuable for the celebration of liturgy. This is what Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians, that the sin of the Corinthians was that they had entered into a kind of sectarianism in the celebration of the liturgy, and they wanted to make themselves a party apart. And he says, nope, everything has to be done in unity and charity. So if that describes your experience of the Latin Mass, then that criticism was meant for you. And if it doesn't describe your experience of the Latin Mass, then perhaps your community is collateral damage.
Michelle writes in, what is the reason the New Testament writers used presbyter instead of priest? Recently, I was told that if these ministers were actually considered to be priests, the Greek word for priest, hierius, would have been used. I'm clueless as to how to respond. Can you help?
Yeah, thanks. So you know that we use the word presbyter in present Catholic vernacular to refer to the priesthood. And in fact, you talk about the collection of priests in your diocese as the presbyterate. And we have meetings of the senior priests in our diocese, every diocese, and it is referred to as the presbyteral council. And so the word presbyter, meaning elder or authority, is interchangeable with the office of the term priest, which refers to his specific sacrificial function. Now, that there is a sacerdotal office in the New Testament leadership structure is taught explicitly by Jesus and the apostles, regardless of the question of title, which ultimately is just kind of a semantic thing, doesn't go to the essence of it. St. Paul, in Romans chapter 15, explicitly refers to himself as a priest, or he talks about his priestly duty of offering the Gentiles as a pure offering to God. And the office of a priest is to offer sacrifice, and he absolutely makes this identification, that his job is to configure the offering to be given to God. Now, of course, Peter's epistle describes the whole nation as a kingdom of priests offering spiritual sacrifices through Jesus. And Paul tells everybody in Romans 12 that they are to offer their bodies as living sacrifices. And so the sacerdotal and sacrificial nature of Christian life is endemic to New Testament teaching about Christian identity, and specifically and uniquely to the apostolic office and to their successors as being the ones that effect this sacrifice in the Christian community. Now, if you look at, again, Paul's letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, the Eucharistic sacrifice is particularly in view as the sacrificial act of the church. And when Christ instituted the Holy Supper on Holy Thursday, the command he gave to his apostles was, "Do this in memory of me." And if you look at the underlying Greek text there, there are strong sacrificial overtones. You might even be able to render it, "Offer this in my memorial." So Christ is one that instituted the priesthood, the sacrifice of the new law being the sacrifice of the Mass, which expresses and helps to constitute the sacrifice of our very selves, our very own priestly and sacerdotal act.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. It's a free telephone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Through redemptive Catholic journalism, EWTN News helps provide and advance the gospel and teachings of the Church. Get our trusted Catholic news right in your email inbox. Simply visit EWTN.com and click on subscribe. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? 833-288-3986. We have an anonymous email. This person writes in, "My daughter's friend grew up a Catholic and married a non-Catholic divorced man in her 20s and had two children. She is now in her 30s, divorced, and going to marry another divorced non-Catholic man with children. I'm Catholic, but my family is not, so is it wrong for me to attend this wedding even though I know it's wrong? Dr. Anders, what would you do?"
Yeah, thanks very much. So, the "what would I do" question is a bit tricky because I don't really know you or your family or the larger situation and the relationships involved. And so prudence, which always demands a knowledge of the particulars, is denied to me in this case. So here are some of the issues that you have to consider. A Catholic woman who is marrying a non-Catholic divorced man without an annulment, not in the Church would regard this as an invalid wedding, an invalid marriage, obviously. Now, if this woman is not practicing the Catholic faith, sounds like she's not, has no interest in the Catholic faith at all, I would weigh the question of how will my refusal to participate be understood? Will it be understood at all? And what kind of message am I sending, if any? And to whom? And so there is a question of, you know, the people who are involved in the wedding directly, the bride and groom, so to speak. Also might be a question of maybe you have your own family, or you have your own children, and you're trying to have to set an example for them about the nature of marriage and so forth. So those are, you have to weigh those. Now, in my personal judgment, depending on the relationship, I have to also consider, if I refuse to attend, will I cut off any opportunity that I have for a relationship with this couple down the road? And would a relationship with them be an occasion for maybe helping them to have a more favorable view of Catholicism and maybe come back to the practice of the faith and ultimately to regularizing their marriages? Or would I simply confirm them by my tacit approval or my quiet approval, seemingly, you know, quiet presence at the wedding, in these bad decisions? And these are prudential choices that you have to make based on the particulars of the relationship and the circumstance. I can think, I would admit to thinking of situations where I would be present at a wedding ceremony that was irregular from the church's point of view, if I thought it was prudent to do so for the sake of maintaining a relationship in the hopes that I could bring someone to a deeper appreciation of the Catholic faith and maybe to regularization down the line. But that would be mitigated if doing so would cause scandal, say, to my own children, for example.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. First up today is Betsy in Dearborn, Michigan, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Betsy, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders. So I am with Jacob in a tow truck who was raised Baptist. He's not religious. And we put on your radio program. And so we're talking about faith and religion, and he has a question. Why did Jesus tell the woman at the well to sin no more? What did he mean by that? What did she take it to mean? He knew she was going to sin, so why did he say that to her?
Oh, yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, see, the Catholic point of view is that with God's grace, it is possible not to sin. It's not inevitable that you won't sin, but neither is it inevitable that you will sin. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus exhorts us to be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And again, the Catholic belief is that moral perfection, a life without sin, is actually possible with grace. Now, I didn't say it was easy. And in fact, there's a whole branch of Catholic spirituality, Catholic mysticism we call it, which is about the gradual transformation of the human person, psychology, interior life, affectivity, like totally changing my interior disposition, that so that it becomes easier and easier to live a life of virtue and harder to sin. And the Catholic faith has very specific practices and disciplines to help inculcate this life of holiness. But, you know, we have these examples. We have these exemplars in Catholic life. We call them saints. Saints are people who live the Catholic faith so heroically, so virtuously, so charitably, that by the time they died, they actually had eliminated sin from their lives. Now, many times Baptists will hear this, or some non-Catholic hears this, and they say, that's absolutely impossible. Nobody could live without sin. But part of what motivates that response, I think, is a misunderstanding of what sin is, all right? And here's the nature of the misunderstanding. We will never be able to eliminate all of our immoderate desires. I often say on the show, you know, I have an immoderate desire for pecan pie. I grew up in the South. You know, my great aunt had a pecan tree in her front yard, and every holiday it was pecan pies all day long, you know. And I can remember many a happy day in my childhood and adolescence when I made myself sick on pecan pie and ice cream. I could really just let myself go with pecan pie. And if you put one in front of me today, I would really genuinely enjoy that, right? And I'll never get rid of that disposition. However, with advancing age and change in my blood sugar and a bit more maturity and have my rational faculties about me a bit more, I actually haven't touched a pecan pie in I think going on 5 years now. Yeah, my name is David, and I'm a pecan pie addict, and I've been sober from pecan pies for 5 years. I really actually haven't touched one, even though the disposition will always be there, right? Now, in a lot of Protestant theology, the idea that I have an immoderate disposition, like let's say that for many people has the immoderate desire for sex out of marriage, for example, you know, like having a desire, sexual desire for someone I'm not married to, they would say, well, that desire is a sin. You're in sin because you have that desire. The Catholic faith says, actually, no, the desire itself isn't the sin. Acting on the desire is the sin. And that would include, you know, actively cultivating, you know, lustful thoughts for the purpose of sort of stimulating myself. But to actually have the implicit desire itself is not sinful. And once you make that distinction between the inclination and sin itself, the positive act, you begin to see, okay, maybe I could do that, you know, because I would challenge your driver. Let's talk about a concrete act of evil that you think is impossible to refrain from doing. And once you put it in those terms, I think you begin to see, all right, well, you know, would you have to commit this particular act of adultery? Well, no, I could probably forego this particular act of adultery. Okay, well, how about the next one after that? Well, I could probably forego that one too. And what do they tell you in AA? Just one day at a time, right? If you can refrain from a particular act of vice, then you can keep doing it. If you have the right habits of life and the right disciplines, and you can continue in that state until death with the aid of grace. Now, without grace, we're sunk. We're not going to do it without grace. We're not going to do it without the teaching of Christ. We're not going to do it without the example of Christ. We're not going to do it without the community of Christian fellowship and Christian worship to support us and sustain us and to train up our habits the right way. But with all those means of grace, taking it one day at a time and praying every day for the grace of perseverance, it is possible to refrain entirely from sin. Most of us won't get there. I grant you that. But the saints will, and our vocation, every one of us, is to become a saint.
Jacob, we are praying for you. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Joe is in Oakdale, Pennsylvania today, listening on the EWTN app. Joe, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Good afternoon, Doctor. My question is, why do Protestants refuse to make the sign of the cross?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Here's my very simple answer. Catholics do it.
That's Carl Keating's answer as well.
Right. That's a Catholic thing, and we don't want to do things that associate us with Catholics. Now, I'll dig a little bit deeper, okay? In the 16th century, there are a number of Protestant, particularly on the Calvinist side, Reformed Swiss, French Protestants, that were strongly opposed to the veneration of the cross, which they considered to be an act of idolatry, and as they understood it, a violation of what they called the Second Commandment. Catholics think this is the First Commandment, the prohibition on images. They broke it out, made its own commandment, and said you can't honor any kind of image at all, and they thought that the veneration of the cross was a form of idolatry, and so the sign of the cross got kind of allied to the idea of the veneration of the cross and fell under that prescription on a proscription on idolatry. Also, I think that some Protestants have the idea that the sign of the cross is a kind of superstitious act, that by the mere performance of a ritual that somehow or another one compels a supernatural power. And if you had that idea of the sign of the cross, if a Catholic had that idea, that would be superstitious and that would be wrong. Protestants are just incorrect about the Catholic disposition. You know, I had a Protestant one time confront me and kind of roll the eyes when I made the sign of the cross. And I looked at this individual and I said, what, you don't think God speaks sign language? I mean, the sign of the cross is simply an invocation of the Blessed Trinity. That's all it is. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I'm committing myself, consecrating myself to the Blessed Trinity, seeking the Lord's presence in my life. Jesus says, whoever loves me and obeys my commandments, the Father and I will come to him, make our dwelling within him. Well, I can't think of anything, any gesture more indicative of that desire than to literally cross my breast with the sign of Jesus, of his crucifixion, as an invocation to the Blessed Trinity to come and make their dwelling within me.
Thanks, Joe. We appreciate the call. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Mary is in Yakima, Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Mary, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. David Anders.
Thank you very much. My question is, what does the Vatican stand regarding refusing the Holy Eucharist to men in power, men or women in power, that support pro-life? And additionally, I was wondering if you could explain the letter from the Vatican to the bishops that was dated May the 7th.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I'm not going to be able to give an extensive commentary on the May 7th letter. I could if I had time to review it ahead of the call, but I hadn't read it in a while, and so it's not fresh in my memory. So I have to speak very impressionistically here. So the Church's teaching is now and has always been that a person who is in a condition of grave sin cannot safely receive Holy Communion. First of all, it's they are at risk of committing a sacrilegious communion, which does them absolutely no good. It doesn't advance them in the life of charity, doesn't advance them in grace. It could actually deepen their state of alienation from God, and so it's dangerous to perform a sacrilegious communion. It's also dangerous to the common good of the church because of the probability of scandal. If somebody goes forward and receives communion when they're in a publicly scandalous state of life, then their neighbor is likely to look at them and say, oh, well, this must be okay for me to receive communion like that. And so that's it does harm to the communicant, and it does harm to the common good of the society of the Catholic Church. So for that reason, without sacramental confession, no one, whether they're a politician or otherwise, should receive Holy Communion if they are in either the state of mortal sin or in some kind of grave public scandal. Now, when it comes to politicians specifically, the Church has a very long history of censuring politicians for scandalous behavior, right? Going back to the 4th century, we've been doing this, and has a lot of experience with what are the ramifications of doing that? And any bishop that censures a politician or a public person has to contend with two different dynamics. One of them, again, is that issue of scandal, right? If this person comes forward to Holy Communion, and I don't make a fuss about it, then is everybody going to tacitly believe that that this behavior is okay? So that's a big issue. That's why some bishops have explicitly said, hey, if you're a politician and you take stands publicly, they're flat contrary to the public teaching of the Catholic Church, do not present yourself from Holy Communion. But there is an opposite danger as well, and prudence demands that you consider this, and that is, what if everybody in the room considers the bishop's action simply from the point of view of partisan politics? And so, it's portrayed that way, it's construed that way by the media. So rather than getting at the underlying moral question, what is actually being communicated through the media and misunderstood in the act is, the bishop is just a player in a political game, and he's a partisan person. That is a different kind of scandal, right? Because the Church doesn't teach that you have to be a member of a particular political party in order to belong to the Catholic faith. And so I know that Pope Francis is concerned about that. He's concerned about the misunderstanding of the discipline and it being allied to political ideology. And so any bishop has to kind of weigh the pros and cons there when he makes his disciplinary decisions.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. A couple of open lines and plenty of time for your calls at 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Back to the phones we go. Nick is up next. He is in the great state of South Dakota, listening to Real Presence Radio today. Nick, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hey, Dr. Anders. Thanks for having me. I just have a question. I have a good friend who is in seminary in the Calvinist tradition. And so that's sort of why I wanted to call, because I know that's how, where you come from. And at this point, we have conversations. He's not very open, like, to taking Catholicism very seriously. So I know you don't know a lot about him, but just since that's your background, what would you think is a good place to start, at least just to, that's sort of my question.
Yeah, I'm sure. Absolutely. I can give you a lot of resources. So for me personally, what started the ball rolling towards the Catholic faith was a reconsideration of the doctrine of justification by faith alone. And that came through a couple of sources. One was my exposure to a whole school of modern biblical scholarship that basically, this was by Protestants, I should add, Protestant biblical scholarship, that concluded that Martin Luther and the Reformed tradition had radically misunderstood St. Paul. And some of the luminaries of this school of scholarship would be N.T. Wright, former Bishop of Durham, Anglican theologian, who is not a Catholic, in fact, no friend of Catholicism, but he repudiates the traditional Reformed and Lutheran understanding of justification. And Wright's book, Justification, is in fact a response to the Reformed Baptist pastor John Piper, who had written a criticism of Wright about justification, and Wright's defense of his position is in that aforementioned book, Justification by N.T. Wright. Christer Stendahl, Lutheran biblical scholar, now deceased, from Harvard University, has a book entitled Paul Among Jews and Gentiles. That was a watershed moment in my study of the writings of St. Paul, radically changed my approach to the subject, and ultimately led me to Catholicism. Another one, slightly more recent title, this I think by a Catholic, I'm not sure if he's Catholic, Matthew J. Thomas's book, Paul's Works of the Law in the Second Century Apostolic Fathers, which is a study of how the very earliest Christians in the second century understood and received the letters of St. Paul and what they thought he was talking about. Another book would be Alistair McGrath, again, an Anglican, not a Catholic. His two-volume History of Justification, Justitia Dei, in which he acknowledges that Luther's understanding of justification was a complete theological novelty, something Luther made up out of whole cloth that had no precedent whatsoever at all in Christian tradition. T.F. Torrance, a famous neo-Orthodox theologian, wrote a dissertation on the doctrine of grace in the Apostolic Fathers, again concluded that that Luther's doctrine was an innovation. Adolf von Harnack, probably the most famous Protestant historian of dogma, early part of the 20th century, his History of Doctrine, comes to the same conclusion. And then, of course, reading the Fathers themselves. Nobody more important to me than St. Augustine of Hippo. And let's go straight to the text that Luther thought was so important, on the Spirit and the Letter, De Spiritu et Litera, by St. Augustine, which clearly teaches the Catholic and not the Reformed doctrine of justification. So the doctrine of justification was a big, big, big problem for me. When I realized that the best in modern Protestant scholarship, biblical scholarship and historical scholarship, did not support the classical Lutheran and Reformed understanding of the nature of salvation. And then when I looked to the writing of the Fathers themselves, I came to the conclusion that the father most important to the Reformers, namely Augustine of Hippo himself, held the Catholic and not the Reformed understanding of the nature of salvation. So I really couldn't hold the Calvinist doctrine of justification and maintain my fidelity to the Bible or to any claim to continuity with Christian antiquity. So that was a pretty big problem for me. Here's another problem for me. Another big problem for me was the writing of John Calvin himself, right? John Calvin, who's the progenitor of the Reformed tradition, major theologian of the Reformed tradition. Now, why do I say that? Because when I dug into Calvin, what I found in Calvin was a theology in many respects far more Catholic than what modern Presbyterian and Reformed Protestants were willing to admit. There was a sacramentalism in Calvin, an ecclesiocentrism in Calvin, a doctrine of ministerial authority in Calvin that was absolutely vastly different from what, say, modern Protestantism would hold. Calvin, for example, strongly believed in the doctrine of Christ's real presence in the Eucharist, although he had a different way of formulating it from Catholics. He clearly believed that Christ was substantially present in the Eucharist. He uses that language of a true and substantial presence. And not only did he believe that doctrine, but he believed that it was a matter essential to salvation. And so I think in about 1541, Calvin wrote a little treatise called The Little Treatise on the Lord's Supper, Tractate sur la Sainte Cène, and in which he made the claim that knowledge of the doctrine of the Eucharist, including the real presence, was so necessary for salvation. Tant nécessaire au salut, he wrote. Well, that was a shock to me, because I grew up Presbyterian, and yet never heard the idea that the belief in the real presence, or the substantial presence of Christ in the Eucharist, was a matter necessary for salvation. Yet Calvin clearly believed that. Calvin believed that baptism was an occasion, not a universal cause, but clearly an occasion for the regeneration of the elect unto salvation. Again, not a doctrine that I grew up with, this sacramentalism. Calvin's understanding of ministerial authority, that to be excommunicated by the church from its visible society would consign one to outer darkness and to potentially deprive one of grace and salvation. Not something that I grew up with. So here are some resources to further explore Calvin's own ecclesiology and how, even though he wasn't Catholic, I realized that he was unwilling to jettison some of the core Catholic ideas that Protestantism had since walked away from. You might take a look at my little article, How John Calvin Made Me a Catholic. You can find that at the Call to Communion website. You might also look at my article, Have You Been Born Again? Catholic Reflections on a Protestant Doctrine. Or an article I wrote on Calvinist authority and soteriology called Tradition One and Sola Fide. You might also look at, if you have the stomach for it, you could take a look at my doctoral dissertation on Calvin. It's entitled Prophets from the Ranks of Shepherds, John Calvin's Critique of Popular Religion. So those are some resources for you to get started with, and those are some of the ideas that were transformative for me.
Still time for your calls at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Noel is a first-time caller. Noel is a first-time caller in Houston, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Noel, you're on with David Anders.
Yes, hello. It's Noel. You had it right the first time. But I had a question now. Why do Catholics, or do Catholics believe that only Catholics will make it to heaven?
Nope. Catholics do not believe this. That is not what we believe. How's that for you?
That's straight to the point.
Yeah, we don't believe that. What do Catholics actually believe? Let me tell you what we believe. So, to get to heaven, you have to die with God's grace and love in your heart. That's how you get there. You die with God's grace and love in your heart. Now, we believe that the Catholic faith, the Catholic Church, the Catholic sacraments, the teaching of the Catholic faith, is the most manifest and efficacious way of getting God's grace and love into your heart. But it's not the only way. It's just the most manifest and efficacious way. There are other ways, if God grant. So I liken it to this. Imagine that you have an infection. You got a sinus infection. You'd like to get well. Are antibiotics the only way to get well? No. You could let the infection run its course. And you might get well without antibiotics. But the most manifest and efficacious way is take the darn pill. You're going to get better, faster, more assuredly if you take the pill. Catholicism is kind of like the pill. It cures the infection of sin and the wounds of original sin and moves us, if we take it according to the instructions on the bottle, it moves us more efficaciously towards the life of grace and charity. But God can extend grace to people outside the formal boundaries of the Catholic Church, but he has, as it were, less to work with. And what do I mean by that? So one of the teachings of the Catholic Church is that you need to have God's love in your heart to go to heaven. Well, are there people outside the Catholic Church that have God's love in their heart? Yes, clearly there are. But many of them belong to churches that teach that that's unnecessary, that what you need to get to heaven is faith alone and not charity. Well, if you're in a church that teaches you don't actually need to be charitable to get to heaven, that all you need is faith alone, That teaching alone won't prevent you from having charity, but it'll constitute an obstacle, an impediment. Because when you find yourself being uncharitable, you might conclude, well, this isn't going to keep me out of heaven. And that might impede your repentance, might impede your contrition. So that's why I say it's not impossible for someone outside the Catholic faith to be saved, but that false teaching might make it harder for them to be saved. The Catholic teaching is more manifest and plain. You actually need charity. So how about the means of grace? Well, in addition to the teaching of the Church, she has means of grace, in particular the sacraments. Supernaturally efficacious signs that demonstrate and express to us those truths that save us, like the necessity of rebirth and regeneration in the Holy Spirit. That's what baptism confers upon us. Well, if you have access to Catholic baptism, you have this efficacious sign that effects rebirth, and you draw on the wellspring of this sacrament to perpetually deepen your penetration into the mystery of Christ, helping you to die to yourself and rise again to new life. Well, that's a tremendous, tremendous aid in the life of grace. Does it mean that without baptism that there's no chance that God will regenerate you? No, it doesn't mean that. But you're depriving yourself of a wonderful means of grace. So you don't have to be Catholic to go to heaven, but being Catholic is a tremendous advantage on the path to heaven.
Join us tomorrow for More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popcheck, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. The topic tomorrow, are you getting caught in the comparison game? Dr. Greg and Lisa will help you break free tomorrow. More to Life on EWTN Radio, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Next up is Ken, a first-time caller in Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day E-Radio. Ken, you're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. Anders. How are you doing today?
I'm all right, thanks. How about you?
Great. Can confession be completed over the phone?
No. Confession cannot be completed on the phone. The tangibility and presence of the priest is an essential part of the sacrament, right? The nature of sacraments as such is that they are tangible, sensible signs in contact with which we encounter and experience God's grace. And it is precisely their tangibility that constitutes a large part of their significance. So, you know, look, I understand the desire here. Many times I've maybe been on the road or something, and I'm away from my favorite priest, and I would just love to get a phone call and hear a word of absolution. I get that. But when I actually go into the confessional and I'm physically present to a priest, and, you know, physical presence is a powerful emotional moment in the life of a human being, right? I mean, few of us would say, well, you know, I wonder if I could just go out with my friends virtually tonight. You know, maybe my wife and I can have a virtual date. No, we want to be in physical proximity to those that we love. There's a meaning there that transcends mere language or affirmation. And the same thing is true of the sacrament.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Next up is Jim. He is in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Jim, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Anders, I had a question, and I think I'm explaining it the way I told the screener. You talked about receiving communion in a state of grace. And my question was, okay, I happened to be watching the old movie called Judgment at Nuremberg, and the trial guy, the judge, was bothered by whether or not the German people knew that the Holocaust was going on. And so fast forward to now, some of the bishops have said some people know that the abortions are going on and they've accepted it. And are they responsible for the 52 million abortions or whatever? So that's kind of my question. Compared to Germany, if you know that those fetuses are being eliminated, are the people responsible that accept it, or is it just the person that has the abortion and the person performing the
abortion? Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the Catholic Church has a fairly nuanced understanding of cooperation with sin, right? And there are some ways in which we can cooperate with sin for which we are culpable and we're guilty of the sin. There are other ways that we can cooperate in which maybe our culpability is mitigated or lessened down to the vanishing point. Let me explain some of these distinctions. So there's a kind of cooperation. The church calls this formal cooperation. Formal cooperation is when you intend the evil act. However you cooperate formally, whatever the means of your cooperation, if it's formal cooperation, if you're trying to bring about the evil act, then you are definitely guilty of the sin. So could I think, for example, of a Catholic person, a Catholic layperson, a Catholic bishop, a Catholic priest, who could be formally guilty of the sin of abortion by silence, right? So in other words, let's say you had a bishop who said, look, I might be able to stand in the gap here and prevent this abortion or these abortions, but I actually secretly want there to be abortions, and I want this to be the case. And so I by my silence, am going to try to further the frequency of abortion. Well, a bishop that took that stance, yes, would be guilty of the sin of abortion because he'd be formally cooperating with it. But let's look at a different situation. Let's look at a situation of a bishop who says, all right, you know, abortion is a terrible thing. I really don't want there to be abortion, but I'm a coward. I'm a coward. And so I'm afraid to stand up and say something because I might lose my position, or I might go to jail, or I might lose my popularity, or this big donor who was going to donate to my favorite cause is going to pull back. And so out of cowardice, I'm not going to say something. It wouldn't be the same thing as formal cooperation. This might be, as another kind of cooperation, material cooperation, where you sort of give people what they need to do the sin without actually directly willing the sin. And it can be culpable or not, depending on how proximate it is. And so in this case, at least the bishop would be guilty of cowardice. That would be, you know, maybe lesser degree than murder, be cowardice. And maybe by his actions was actually creating a material condition that could facilitate abortion, for which he would be more or less guilty depending on his proximity and how necessary his silence was to the performance of the act.
Jim is watching us on YouTube. He says, can you explain the quote-unquote born-again statement I hear evangelical Christians use a lot, but not necessarily by Catholics?
Absolutely. So Catholics should all be talking about being born again all the time because our Lord Jesus tells us that this is necessary for entrance into the kingdom of heaven. Unless a man is born again, he cannot enter into the kingdom of heaven, John chapter 3. Now, the standard Catholic view on this is that our regeneration occurs in baptism, and that seed of eternal life begun, which is God's grace in our heart, then can grow over the course of a whole life, continually transforming us more and more into the likeness and image of God until we finally attain to glory with Him. So it begins in sacred baptism, but it's a lifelong process of being transformed ultimately into the person of Jesus, and that's necessary for salvation. Now, that's not exactly what Protestants mean by it. So, in the way evangelicals usually use the word, they are typically referring to a momentary conversion, a crisis moment of conversion, in which a person makes a conscious decision to follow Christ and to invite Jesus into his heart. So, rather than really signifying the sacrament of baptism, the seed of which continues throughout life, they typically have in mind a singular moment of psychological conversion when one makes the decision to follow Jesus. And typically, while they do think there is an interior change that takes place, that also is the occasion for God imputing Christ's righteousness, so that God ends up saving the individual for Christ's sake through faith alone, and not through this interior transformation of the moral life.
Karina is watching us on Facebook Live. She asks, why does my Protestant friend think all sins are the same? for instance, equal in weight?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. It's because Protestants reject the idea of merit, right? So it's really central to Protestant understanding of salvation that we're saved by faith alone, and not by the transformation of our moral life. So simply for the sake of Christ, God counts us as if we are righteous, even though we remain objectively sinful. That's the Protestant point of view. All you've got to do is believe in Christ, invite him into your life, and then your salvation is guaranteed. So the idea that that there could be sort of degrees of justification doesn't make any sense to a Protestant. Either God acquits you or he doesn't, right? Whereas on the Catholic view of things, there absolutely are degrees of penetration into the mystery of Christ in the life of grace and charity. One man can have more grace than another. Concrete, specific acts that we perform can, in fact, merit specific rewards from Jesus. He says, if you fast in secret, if you pray in secret, if you get alms in secret, our Father who sees you in secret will reward you. There are concrete, specific things you can do that can advance you in the life of grace and salvation. But if that's the case, then there are degrees of glory and there are degrees of merit and demerit. And that's the thing the Protestant can't abide.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Might be able to squeeze one more call in at 833-288-3986. Shelley writes in, Dr. Andrews, my NAB Bible does not seem to attribute the letter of James to one of the apostles named James. It suggests a third James, usually called Brother of the Lord. However, I thought the Apostle James was referred to as Brother of the Lord. Can you help clear this up for me?
Yeah, so there's James, who is the disciple, one of the 12. Then there's James, who is the Brother of the Lord, who was not one of the 12. Now, they're both apostles, and they're both named James. But one was in the company of the disciples, and one was not. So that's part of the confusion. So there you go.
John's watching us on YouTube. Why did God allow Abraham to commit adultery and impregnate Hagar when God was going to give Abraham and his son Isaac?
Right. So first of all, you can ask the same question about why does God permit any sin? You know, why does God permit me to eat that third piece of pecan pie, for example, and commit the sin of gluttony? God always permits sin because he intends to bring out of sin a greater good. Now, in this particular instance, what is the greater good that God brings out of Abraham's infidelity? Well, according to St. Paul, the business with Hagar and Sarah functions as an allegory for life according to the flesh and according to the spirit. And the story of the people of Israel, the call of Abraham, the redemption of the people of God from slavery, all of that is a kind of is an allegory, a typology, pointing us to the reality of transformation of life in Jesus. And you can read about this in Paul's letter to the Galatians.
Katie's watching on YouTube, wants to know if corporate sin is classified as mortal or venial.
By corporate, are we talking about like the sin of a collective?
I would imagine.
Is that what I mean? Is that
I would tend to think he's thinking about societal ills.
Sure. Well, if you're talking about social sins, they could be mortal or venial depending on their gravity and the other conditions of a mortal sin. So, you know, if I'm complicit in chattel slavery, for example, right? I go out and I foment human trafficking in a way that brings about grave indignity to the individual, and I do this with impunity, and I participate in that, and yeah, that could be mortally sinful in my case.
And finally, Gretchen wants to know if it's a sin to not go to church every Sunday, and what about feast days?
It's a sin not to go to church on Sundays unless you have some legitimate excuse, like illness, for example, or perhaps you have to travel for work in a way that makes it absolutely impossible for you to go. I mean, there are mitigating circumstances, but all things being equal, we are required, we're obligated to attend Mass on Sundays and holy days of obligation.
Well, there you have it.
There you have it.
We've done it once again here on EWTN's Call to Communion. We invite you every time, Monday through Friday at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, to answer that question for us. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic. On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, our producer, Charles Beery, our call screener, Matt Gubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Jeff Burson, I'm Jack Williams, once again sitting in for Tom Price. Thanks so much for tuning in. Until we get together next time, God bless.